The Triathlon Show 346. Up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Andy Blow, the founder of Precision Fuel and Hydration. In this episode we discuss caffeine and how it can be used to enhance endurance performance. But before that, big thanks to our sponsors. First, Precision Fuel and Hydration is the sponsor of today's episode. And because Andy is on the show, I'll leave out the preamble, but just wanted to remind you that you can get 15% off your first order of Precision Fuel and Hydration products by using the code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And that includes the new caffeine gel. And thank you to Zen8. The Zen8 Indoor Swim Trainer is a swim training tool that you can use at home, allowing you to improve your technique, work on power and stamina, and save time and stay consistent, even when you're not able to go to the pool. It's a fantastic way to work on swim-specific core activation, because the instability element of the bench forces you to stabilize your core, and it helps you work on a high elbow catch, as the height of the swim bench is perfectly designed for forcing you to keep that elbow up. You can get tips and workouts on the Zen8 social media channels like Instagram and also on their YouTube channel. And remember, the Zen8 Swim Trainer is very affordable, and even more so with the 20% discount code that you can get on zen8swimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's my interview with Andy Blow. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, Andy. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Michael. Really good. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And I have, we have an exciting topic for today with caffeine, which is something that for listeners that have not listened to episode 234, I highly recommend that, because that's where I talked with Dr. Ashmol Ali about the science of caffeine. But today we're going to talk about that a little bit, but also about a lot more of the practical sides and rigorously collected anecdotal data that you have from a lot of athletes. So I'm excited for it. Can you discuss first maybe a summary of, just a brief summary for those that are not familiar with the science of caffeine? What does it say about its use in endurance events and how it affects endurance performance?
Yeah, for sure. I think a good place to start is even maybe a slight step back from that and just go, you know, what do you need when you're completing an endurance event? And we've talked about this a lot before, but fundamentally, when the costs of doing an endurance event are that you sweat and you lose fluid and sodium, so they need to be replaced. You burn calories, mostly in the form of carbohydrates, so you need to burn carbs. And we call those three things, you know, the fluid, sodium, and carbohydrate, the three key levers that you need to pull when you're doing an endurance event. They're the three inputs that you need. But a potential fourth one, although you don't need it per se, but one that is significant enough that we include it in all of the athlete case studies we look at because we're interested in how it influences performance, is ingestion of caffeine. Because caffeine essentially is a stimulant. It acts on the central nervous system and on the brain in order to essentially influence perception of fatigue and ability to perform, especially when you're tired. So caffeine has the potential certainly to enhance performance in endurance sport. And as your previous podcast on the subject delved into in a great deal of detail, there are a lot of studies that back up that assertion largely. So this is basically one of the very few ergogenic supplements that are marketed, which does have the potential to boost performance.
Yeah, and actually, you listened to the episode over the weekend. I haven't listened to it for a long time, but of course, you're familiar with the research anyway from your work with developing caffeine products recently. But I think it's 2-3% that is touted as the performance benefit from using caffeine. Is that right?
Yes, it's about 2.5 or 2.9, I think, percent. Was from the meta-analysis that looked at lots and lots of different papers, kind of came up with the idea that the average improvement was 2.9%, which is definitely significant because, again, as is pointed out in detail in your previous podcast, for an elite athlete, certainly anything approaching even 0.5% improvement is potentially significant. And so when you get into whole single digit percentages of improvement, if it's relatively cost effective and easy, low risk strategy to implement, it's worth having a look at, which is why I think caffeine does fall into the bracket of something that's certainly worth most athletes having a bit of a dive into and seeing if it might work for them. Of course, what the 2.9% improvement doesn't encapsulate is the range of different improvements. And I think some people could expect significantly more improvements, performance improvement from that. But also there is going to be a cohort of people who won't experience improvement, and then some who may even experience a detrimental effect. And so it's important to, you know, I'm sure we'll get into those kind of areas as we discuss it.
Oh yeah, for sure. What is the recommended dose of caffeine that you would need to take to see these benefits, and also how what can you tell us about when to take it and even in what form to take it perhaps?
Yeah, so caffeine is generally recommended in terms of, whereas carbohydrate, for example, we'd recommend in absolute terms like 60, 90, 100 grams an hour or whatever it is, almost independent of body size. Excuse me, caffeine is very much always recommended in terms of milligrams per kilogram of body weight. So it's related to body size, because the ability of the body to metabolize caffeine is quite closely linked to your total size. So generally speaking, it's recommended that you take somewhere between 3 and 6 milligrams per kilo of body weight to maximize the effects. And we can, again, shortly, we can probably dive into some of the case studies we've got to look at what that looks like in terms of actual total amounts of caffeine and how athletes dose that through a race in order to keep levels up. In terms of timing of caffeine, that's an interesting one, because caffeine takes a little bit of a time to have full effect on the body. Everyone varies a bit, and to a certain extent, it might vary on what you've eaten or what you've drunk and things like that. But generally speaking, when you take something caffeinated, you'll probably start to get caffeine into the bloodstream after about 15 minutes, but then it's unlikely to peak for up to 45 to 60 minutes. So it can be an hour after you've had a cup of coffee, say, that you're getting the peak effects of the caffeine. And then following on from that, the half-life, the half-life is when caffeine in the body is metabolized to 50% of its peak value. That can take, several hours, around 3 hours or so. And that, again, that can vary from person to person. But so you get this kind of relatively quick uptake, and it starts to have effects. It peaks after an hour, and then it takes quite a few hours to degrade. So understanding the dynamics of that influences the timing of when you take caffeine, because a very typical mistake I've seen with a lot of athletes, and one I'll totally throw my hands up and say I used to make myself, was having a caffeine gel or something really, really at the end of an event, because you think that's when you're going to need a boost, when you're really tired. And actually, you can take it way too late, and the benefits will hit you when you've crossed the finish line. So they're good for the after race party, but not really good for the race itself.
Yeah, you're right. That's I see that quite commonly as well. Just to give a reference for you mentioned the 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram body weight. Can you give some examples of, for example, how many milligrams of caffeine would you find in a regular espresso or a big black coffee or something like that?
Yeah, coffee's always a difficult one to nail down, and I'll have to dig it out for you. There's a good reference online with a very comprehensive table of different caffeinated, different types of coffee and different measures and things and roughly how much caffeine. But if you use a really rough rule of thumb and say between 75 and 100 milligrams of caffeine in a pretty standard coffee, I don't think you're going to be too far away. Obviously, if the coffee's a lot smaller and weaker, it's going to be less than that. And you might get, if you've got a quad shot, something or another, it might be significantly more. It could be a couple of hundred milligrams, but it's kind of in that zone. Things like Coca-Cola are about 10 milligrams per 100 milliliters, something like that. So about 30 something milligrams for a can. And kind of energy drinks like Red Bull are about 3 times that. So more closer to 30 milligrams per 100 mil.
Yeah. So we're when you put in those terms, let's say we have a 70 kilogram person and they're looking to get at least 210, that would be the 3 milligrams per kilogram, then they would be looking at something like two and a half equivalents of a coffee or almost to reach that minimum. So that's quite useful to get a better idea of how much caffeine we're talking about.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's something in that zone. And a common one, again, we can talk specifics in more depth, but I think a common one that's quite useful for athletes if they're habitual caffeine users is a strong coffee an hour or so before an event, followed up with a caffeine gel in the last 10 or 15 minutes before the start. That gives you a kind of a dosing regimen that works quite nicely, because the coffee is probably peaking around the start time, and then you're putting another quick dose in, which is going to then kick in after 45 minutes to an hour and help keep the levels topped up. And for me, if that's a route, that can be quite a successful routine for a lot of athletes.
Absolutely. Yeah. One thing that when I've looked at the science of caffeine that always stands out in the application of the science into practice is that science has been looking at the performance or events such as a 5K running race or time trial or a 20K bike time trial or 40K bike time trial, generally speaking, events that last up to 1 hour or so and not much longer. I haven't seen anything with looking at even marathon running, it's generally much shorter than that, which is obviously because mostly these are laboratory studies. So what do you think about how that applies to much longer events, even something like an Olympic distance triathlon, which for a lot of people, well, most people, is 2 hours or more, and it can even be 3 hours or more for many. And then you go up to half and full distance triathlons or ultra running or swim runs. Then we're talking about orders of magnitude, well, not orders of magnitude, but multiples of those distances and events that have been studied in science. How does it still apply in long distance events?
Yeah, you're dead right that there's not a depth of research at all in that longer stuff. There are some crossovers with if we jump first of all to the real ultra stuff, the stuff that lasts, you know, like all day or multiple days even, or overnight and that sort of thing, there are studies that have been done on military service personnel and things like that on the fatigue resisting effects of caffeine that may have relevance in how they dose those, but there's been nothing really looking at ultra sports performance, I don't think. But when you talk about longer stuff, so if you start with, say, Olympic distance triathlon or marathon, which depending on fitness levels are kind of in the same zone time wise for a lot of people, you might be out there for, say, you know, between 2 and 3 and a bit hours if you're a faster athlete in those events. Theoretically, if you have a decent caffeine dose an hour or so before the start, and then potentially, if you can stomach it and if it works for you, back that up with a top up of caffeine, 100 milligrams or so, in the 10 or 15 minutes immediately prior to the start, then theoretically you would have enough caffeine in your system, or certainly towards the lower end, to get a decent effect throughout that race. And that, because the half-life, it'd be tapering off towards the end a little bit, but it shouldn't be such a significant taper that it would be overly influential. You'd imagine, and what we see in practice a lot of the time, is that's how athletes will use caffeine in those events. We do, particularly prevalent in marathon running, in the elite athletes we've seen, a lot of them will take a caffeine gel or a caffeinated drink in the second third of the race, if they're doing it about right, because then theoretically you could be getting a boost of caffeine in the last 2 or 3 miles, when we know that the racing really sort of gets spicy for the elites, and when moves can be made and when fatigue's at its highest. So there might be an argument for an extra dose mid-race, but as we said a few minutes ago, a common mistake for the those that don't understand it quite as well might be to save a caffeine gel for mile 22 or 23 in the marathon, when in actual fact you're so close to the finish. It could psychologically give you a boost if you think it's going to help, but in reality the physiology of that dictates it probably isn't going to help later on. So in summary, I think for those longer but not really long races, like a good dose before, and immediately before, an hour before, a little bit immediately before, and potentially a top up mid-race. So in Olympic distance triathlon, that might look like a caffeinated gel, you know, on the bike, then that's a pretty common and seems to be a pretty viable strategy. So you're keeping the levels up. When you jump up to, say, middle distance, it's kind of an extension of that. You know, you're out there for what, you know, very fast athletes, less than 4 hours, and slower athletes might be 5, 6, or 7 hours on there. Then I still tend to see a lot of athletes will follow a similar pre-caffeination routine, but then it might be 2 or 3 top-up doses throughout the course of the race. Again, making sure you're not leaving the last one till too late. And then for Ironman, you Ironman and ultra stuff that goes on a lot longer, you start to get into a situation where it's like, is the best strategy to pre-caffeinate strongly and then top up throughout? And that might be the case for some athletes, certainly at the faster end. However, there could be a potential advantage for some people in moderating caffeine before the start, on the basis that you will feel the effects to a greater extent if you start to dose during the race, to sort of mitigate the fatigue, the inevitable fatigue that's going to happen later on. And I think certainly in really long ultra stuff, that's where the timing of it gets interesting, because I've heard people theorize and I've seen examples where people have abstained from caffeine before the race and then used it very strategically to, say, get through the night time or through very late stages when natural body cycles and circadian rhythms are telling you to sleep, and you can really use the sleep blocking and fatigue masking power of caffeine by taking it later on in the event, so that you get an enhanced effect at that point when it's going to have more bang for the buck, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I guess that, yeah, there are, you mentioned a couple of factors there that I want to highlight, especially for those really long races. Like if you look at Ironman, for example, as you said, if you're at the faster end, then you still might want to take caffeine before the race, which would make sense because the swim can still be a very critical part, and getting into the first group versus the second group could have a big impact on your race. And yeah, then if you can get an extra couple of percentage points of a boost in performance through the effects of caffeine, then it makes sense to get that early on, because the swim will generally be one of the more intense parts of the day, or one of the most intense parts. But yeah, for somebody for whom that's not important, they want to be very steady and measured throughout the day, then that might be the case where maybe even you might be afraid of how much caffeine you can tolerate. So then you would rather distribute it a bit later through the race when you really might start to need to fight that fatigue as it comes up.
I absolutely agree. And I think a thing you sort of started to touch on there with the start is, for elite athletes and those that are jockeying for position in the swim and who are, you know, going to try and take advantage of it early on, then yeah, taking it away, if you use it regularly especially, is going to potentially put you at a disadvantage if you abstain from it before the start. On the flip side, if you get people who are very, very nervous and very anxious before races, especially, we know that swimming in triathlon is very anxiety inducing for some people. If it's a mass start, if swimming is not your favorite discipline, and the addition of caffeine on top of pre-race nerves and things like that means it can have an augmented effect. And I certainly remember an occasion when I was racing a duathlon in the evening, which was an unusual time of day to be racing. I'm, like most people, more used to racing in the morning. And I took, I can't even remember how much, but I was taking some caffeine before in the form of an energy drink, like a Red Bull. And maybe I had a couple of those, or it was quite an aggressive amount that I took. And coupled with the nerves, because it was an important race for me and everything else, I was standing on the start line and I seemed to think my heart rate was already up at like 160 beats a minute or something. And I was feeling like notably anxious and overstimulated, basically. And I settled in as the race got going, and it wasn't too bad in the end, but it was an unsettling experience, and it wasn't pleasant. And I do put that down to caffeine being layered on top of nerves. So I would say that's a consideration for some people as well, is, you know, to moderate the usage before a race if you are particularly of, you know, of a nervous disposition around racing.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a good lead in to my next question, which would be, are there any people for whom it makes sense not to take caffeine? And you mentioned there one segment and or one aspect to consider. Are there any other things in which scenarios might you not want to take caffeine?
Yeah, well, the theories around that exist, you know, whether you should or shouldn't take caffeine, around the idea that there are people who have different levels of sensitivities and people that metabolize caffeine at different speeds. And if you are highly sensitive to caffeine, as in it has a very pronounced anxiety inducing effect, then that can be a very strong sign that it may not be appropriate. You may be one of the people for whom this is not performance enhancing. It might even be detrimental. And I think based on the scientific studies, it usually throws out a number somewhere in the region of 30% of people, 20 to 30% of people not being either not using caffeine or not finding it advantageous. So I think whilst the majority of people who are tested and studied seem to find it an improvement, there's 20 or 30% that don't. And when I looked at our own data set, which comprised 126 athletes at the moment, for whom we've got a very detailed race case study, we found our number was a little bit higher in terms of using it versus not using it. Nearly 90%, 89% of athletes that we'd studied had used caffeine during an event. And that was across a whole range of endurance events, heavily weighted towards triathlon, but there's running in there, there's cycling in there. And 90% of them had used caffeine to a lesser or greater extent. Some of those dosages were quite small and some were quite large, but there is definitely a cohort of people for whom caffeine is inappropriate. And in one of our recent blogs on the subject, we put together a kind of Venn diagram to help people decide whether caffeine may or may not be for them. And essentially what that Venn diagram is, three overlapping circles. And you look at the three kind of questions it poses are, have you previously used caffeine in a race? Yes or no? And if you answer yes, you're in the middle of the circle. If you answer no, you're in the outside. Have you ever had any of the anxiety sort of signs and symptoms with using caffeine during day-to-day life? Because if you have, and it's caused you problems, then you should lean more towards not using it. And then the third one is around whether you are just a daily habitual caffeine user. So are you someone who has coffee and tea and things on a regular basis? I mean, 90% of the world do, but if you're in the percentages that doesn't, then based on those three factors and the way they overlap, if you use caffeine every day, if you've used it before in races and you've never had adverse effects, then the chances are that's a slam dunk that it's likely to be beneficial for you. If you've got two out of three in the positive, then it seems more than likely it's worth trying and playing around with. But if you're down to one or none of those, then you may be one of those people for whom caffeine is not suitable. So it's not a very exact science, but as you know from your interactions with people, there are just people you meet who say, oh, caffeine, it's not for me. My wife can't drink coffee. You know, she gets all of the adverse effects, the anxiety, even heart palpitations if she overdoes it. And so over the years, she's just learned to back off and have decaf instead.
Yeah. If you are somebody who, let's say you are a regular caffeine consumer and you don't have any negative effects, but you haven't used it in racing before, would you advise trying it out in either a low-key race, like maybe a park run or something, or in training before using it in a major event that you're like your A race for the season or something like that?
Yeah, 100%. Like any part of your strategy, equipment, you know, nutrition, supplementation, I think it's essential that you try to simulate the way you would plan to use it in a race. So in terms of timing, dosage and products, and try that in some of your key harder training sessions and see how that plays out. It's also a brilliant idea to use it in the kind of more low key races, because although they don't simulate the nerves of your massive A race, I think being able to, you can't simulate the nerves of a race in training. And so using a B race, as it were, or even a C race, whatever you want to call it, a low key race to do so can be helpful, because it can also bring in that element of natural race anxiety and seeing how you respond to that.
Yeah. And are there any potential, other than, for example, well, having no benefit and maybe anxiety-inducing effects and so on, are there any potential downsides for caffeine in terms of gastrointestinal distress or things like that that people should be aware of?
Yeah, that's quite individual, but there are enough reports of GI distress from people who use, especially who use larger amounts of caffeine, that it can be a thing for some people. So I would say for sure it's a case of, like with most things, starting at the lower end of the dosage and working up until you reach a point where you're either at the higher end of the dosages or you feel like there's a tapering in benefit, and the more you take on, the more at risk you might become of getting some GI distress. So it doesn't happen to, I would say, in our experience talking with athletes, it seemed that would also appear to be a minority of caffeine users, but there's enough people there to make it significant.
Yeah, and it would generally be quite difficult as well to tease apart what is the factor of GI issues, and it could be a combination of all of the things that you're taking: caffeine and carbohydrate and hydration and so on.
Absolutely, and the fact that in races you're smashing your body really hard, often in a hot environment, blood flow to the gut is reduced, and we know that GI issues are very, very prevalent. So you're 100% right. You can't always put it down to one singular factor. And in fact, it often isn't one singular factor. So you have to do a bit of like trend analysis on yourself to see whether you've ever encountered similar circumstances without caffeine as you have with caffeine.
Yeah. Let's discuss some recommendations for usage during the event, in addition to what you already mentioned from the scientific findings around dosing and so on. So if we talk about before the event and during the event, what would be your general recommendations? And now we're talking to people that are potential users of caffeine. What would the general recommendations be for dosing and maybe any moderating factors to consider?
So up to and including sort of, like we said, faster Ironman athletes who are out there for, not out there for the 14, 15 hours or whatever, I would say quite often pre-caffeination is a good idea, and having some with your breakfast, and maybe even, so if you're having your breakfast many hours from the start, some athletes will need to eat 2 or 3 hours before the start, in which case a little bit of caffeine with that, if that's what you normally do for your breakfast, is probably no bad thing as part of your general, if it's part of your general daily waking up process. Then I would be aiming for a decent dose of caffeine. If we use an average sized athlete, like a 70 kilo man, then something in the sort of 100 to 200 milligram dose about an hour before. So I eat a strong coffee or a product with caffeine in it, followed by a top up dose in the last 10 or 15 minutes, if you can, because that gives you that layered effect of caffeine peaking towards the start of the race and then peaking, or at least being sustained another hour or so later until you get into your during race caffeine intake.
Would the top up dose also be around that 100 milligrams?
I think that comes down to things like convenience and preference and availability. So if you're going to carry lots of caffeine gels, they're a commonly used product, because obviously you're killing two birds with one stone with a single product there. You're going to take carbohydrate energy on regularly, so you can choose to take caffeine on with that. Now, some gels will come with low dosages of caffeine, so that might be 25, 30, 45, even 50 milligrams of caffeine, in which case you can probably take those a smaller drip of those more frequently throughout the bike stage of a middle or Olympic distance, for example, or if you've got one, the caffeine gel, as you know, that we make has 100 milligrams in, with the idea that you would take a larger dose less frequently. And I think, honestly, some of that comes down to personal preference. Some of it just comes down to logistics. I don't think there's a right or a wrong. I just think that you want to be mindful of the total amount that you're taking in. We've seen examples where athletes were either completely unaware that they, until afterwards, that they were taking a product that had caffeine in it, because I think a lot of caffeinated sports nutrition products are kind of not very well labeled. It's not always very clear that they've got caffeine in at all, or how much caffeine they've got. And you can get yourself into a situation where you overconsume caffeine if whatever your preferred product is caffeinated, and you don't realize it, or you don't realize the dosage that it's adding up to. So like with your fluids, your sodiums, your carbohydrates, it's useful to understand and know what your total caffeine numbers are for the race, and then just work through a list of products that you can either take or have access to on the course to make sure you're keeping topped up. You know, one very specific example of where that this actually didn't cause a major problem or derail a performance, but we did an analysis on Leon Chevalier's win in Ironman Mallorca in 2021, where he had the misfortune of his bottle bouncing out of his bike early on, which had most of his gels in it for the bike ride. So he was snatching gels from the course, and for whatever reason ended up with a very high proportion of caffeine gels that he was trying to take for energy in order to make up for the carbohydrates that he'd lost in that bottle. He'd lost nearly all of his bike nutrition in one bottle. And he did a great job in terms of hitting his carbohydrate numbers by grabbing gels on the bike course. But because they were quite highly caffeinated, he ended up consuming something in the region of 1,000 milligrams of caffeine throughout that race. And based on an approximation of his body weight, that could have been as much as 12 or 14 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight during that time. And that's really on the high end of what we've seen in a race. And Leon won that race and didn't report any adverse GI effects really, and didn't have any major problems after the event. But it was certainly unintended, because normally he would be taking probably about half of that amount of caffeine during a race, which is a lot more of a dose which would be sort of considered safe and normal.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it's important to keep in mind for training as well as racing, with the amount, just as you mentioned, being aware of how much caffeine your different sports nutrition products contain, because otherwise you might impact your sleep negatively for that day if you happen to get in a lot of, like, too big a dose of caffeinated products. So, of course, if you have your big A race, then maybe it doesn't matter too much if you overconsume a bit of caffeine, as long as you don't have any issues. You get the performance effects, and yeah, what's one bad night of sleep after that? But yeah, in training, you do want to be especially mindful, I think, with, and this is based on personal experience that I've done, a long ride with exclusively caffeinated gels. I wasn't unaware of that, but I just didn't have any options at home at that time, so I didn't sleep very well, very much that night. it was quite a lot.
Absolutely. And we know that, especially if you train later in the day as well, that can disrupt your sleep on its own. So if you add caffeine into the mix, that can be pretty detrimental. And then you get into that vicious cycle of not recovering very well from those training sessions because you're not sleeping adequately, and it can spiral quite badly. One other thing that sort of, I think it's worth laboring the point, even though it's a simple point, is above all else, the most important thing, once you've established if caffeine might be for you, and you, or you've established that it is for you, it's having a really good understanding of the dosage that works for you that matters. I think that all of these studies and things that get talked about and numbers that get thrown around, they provide a fantastic indication of what a decent strategy might look like, that 3 to 6 milligram window, possibly more in a really long race because of the degradation of the early doses, they've effectively disappeared from the body. So although we quote Leon having 14 milligrams, say, per kilo in the Ironman, the dosages that he took before the race have been fully metabolized and are out of his system by the end. So he's just operating at a higher level, but not right up at that level. I think just if nothing else, it's just really worth zoning in on how many hundreds of milligrams are likely to work for you, and then playing around in that zone to figure it out. Because I think that's probably the Achilles heel of caffeine use for most athletes, is that there is just no great appreciation in most people for what constitutes an effective dose for them. And I think that's when you really boil it down, that's what matters. It's like, how much caffeine do I need personally for me? We don't want to go above those higher recommended, well, much above those higher recommended limits, because there appears to be a diminishing returns on any positive benefits, and a higher risk of GI issues and other you know, anxiety, palpitations or whatever. But at the same time, the bandwidth, if you look in our case studies, the bandwidth for dosages that athletes appear to be using and having good performances, and obviously we're not going to relate their good performances solely to the amount of caffeine that they took in, it's a very small component, but they've performed well with a variety of levels of caffeine in their system, then it sort of tells you that like a lot of things in sport and training and racing, you need to do the N of one test on yourself and figure out what dosage works for you.
Yeah, and that's something that we've discussed in previous episodes with you around the importance of logging these things and being quite specific with your experimentation on yourself, whether it comes down to whether it's about nutrition or hydration, sodium, caffeine, and just getting a really good idea for that in training already, and then racing will be a natural consequence of what you did in training. It will already be optimized, and you don't run the risk of any surprises happening. So I think that's an excellent point. And maybe we transition into those case studies that you mentioned, because I think that could be quite interesting and fun to hear about. Yeah. How much, and maybe we stick to the triathlon events at least. Well, let's start with them anyway. For this one, how much do you see, especially when we look at the elite athletes, then taking in different distances of triathlon that you have gathered data from in your case studies?
Yeah, that's a good one. And all of these case studies, obviously, the individual ones are published on our website. So if anyone wants to have a dive into any individual case study that we mention and have a look at the data, it's all there on the site. But when we look at the middle distance triathlons that we've got with elite athletes, we've got 15 case studies now, very detailed ones, where athletes have consumed caffeine during a middle distance triathlon. And the average... So the average finishing time was 4 hours, 8 minutes. So this is a really elite group.
And it includes men and women.
It includes men and women, correct, yeah. And it's the average is about 3.5 to 3.6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight. So towards the lower end, and that includes a caffeine dose immediately pre for a lot of those athletes. So that's kind of at the lower end. For full distance Ironman, we've got 9 case studies now with an average finishing time, again, pretty quick, of 9 hours, 45 minutes. So still sort of elite, sort of pro and elite and top age groupers. And the average amount of caffeine in those was 6.5 milligrams per kilo, which kind of fits that general picture and trend that obviously the longer you're going, the more caffeine you can take and tolerate. And what's interesting for me there is that 6.5 milligrams is already above that 3-6 recommended ratio. But the big caveat there is that if you're going for 9 or 10 hours, caffeine that you took before the race will have been, if depending on your speed of metabolism, in the majority of cases will have been metabolized towards the end, you know, before the end of the race. So the way that you're topping it up throughout doesn't mean that you've actually taken six. It's not like taking a dose of 6.5 milligrams of caffeine per kilo body weight all in one go. It's probably, you know, which is a very important thing to point out, because you start looking at those numbers and thinking, well, that's, you know, could smash that amount of caffeine and go, well, that's drip fed over a period of time, as opposed to being gone in one hit.
That would be, I remember the first marathon where I, or the first race that I ever consumed caffeine before was a marathon that I did. And being young and dumb, I wanted to be on the high end of things. So I said, well, let's do 6 milligrams per kilogram body weight. Yeah. And then I consumed that amount of some kind of caffeine chews or tablets. And then I didn't feel anything right away. So I was like, let's just get a couple more in there. So I don't know what I ended up taking in the end, but that was all in one go, 1 hour before the marathon. And I got off the metro and I started, I was really jittery and lightheaded and wasn't sure I was going to find my way to the start. I did in the end. And in the end it settled because I think I metabolized caffeine quite quickly. So I did have a good race, but that was definitely very, very excessive and not something I would recommend doing.
On the high end. I think a good analogy with caffeine and the dosing like that is one that anyone who's, you know, been out drinking can relate to, in that what you would have effectively done there is like going out and it's like going to a stag party and you immediately drink 5 pints and 10 shots of Sambuca or something like that and get very, very drunk very, very quickly. And then, you know, it's a high risk strategy. You get very drunk, but it all happens very quickly and gets out of control. Whereas if you go out and have a few drinks spread out over the period of a few hours and your blood alcohol level obviously rises and you feel a little bit merry and tipsy, but you just have a drink every so often, keep the levels up, you probably have a more pleasant overall evening. And, so reading those numbers, it's not about hitting it hard quickly. It's about dripping the dosage in over the time period that's required. And so I think what you did there is like, and we've all done it in our own ways, is a classic athlete thing, is get a small grasp of the science, read some numbers. In that case, it's like the headline thing is 3 to 6 milligrams. Then what we all do is we go, well, if it's 3 to 6, 6 is probably good. And actually what I'll probably do is push it to 8 because, you know, more is likely to be better. And then you don't really take the time to consider the rate at which you infuse it in. You assume this should all be done in one hit. And then before you know it, you've made a potentially, you know, catastrophic decision. So I think just taking time to understand all of that is really important, because sometimes it's good to learn the hard way, but you don't always have to if you're prepared to do a bit of research beforehand.
Yeah. And just coming back to your numbers from the case studies with more than 6 milligrams per kilo for the full distance races, obviously that's an average. And as you highlighted with the Leon Chevalier case study, there will be people that were on the higher end and also people that were lower than that.
I would say
individual.
Yes, it is individual. We've consistently, I think we've seen Fenella Langridge at Ironman St. George taking, I've not got that number in front of me, but it was either 8 or 10 milligrams per kilo throughout the race. Laura Sedell in Challenge Roth last year, 2021, I think, 11 milligrams per kilo throughout the race, which is pretty high. Interestingly, I think that was one where Laura reported back to us like trouble sleeping after the race in particular. Although having said that, you know, you can attribute that to the caffeine. It was certainly a very high dose, but we know a lot of athletes struggle to sleep the night after an Ironman because of the general disruption to your body. So I don't know if you can put it all down to that, but, you know, certainly there's a range. And other athletes we've seen at the lower end, like think I've got one here where we saw Ruth Astle once Ironman South Africa and only had a coffee before and about less than 1 milligram per kilo during the race itself. So there was a use of caffeine there, either planned or inadvertent, but it wasn't significant and she won the race. So, and there are countless examples of good performances where people have used no caffeine at all. So I think it's important to continue to point out, if we haven't labored it enough, that thing that it's individual. And I would say also, unlike getting your hydration and carbohydrate intake about right, that applies to everyone. Everybody needs to get their energy and hydration intake about right, and especially in a long hot race, otherwise you can't expect to perform. If I truly believe that we would never want to do this in this situation, probably wouldn't happen. But even for a habitual caffeine user like Leon, for example, if we took his caffeine away in a race, it is unlikely to benefit his performance. It may be very, very slightly detrimental to it, but I wouldn't expect his performance to crater because he hasn't got caffeine. What we're talking about is something that can give you potentially a small edge beyond where you would be at without it, but it is a relatively small edge. It's not necessarily a game changer. Where I do believe caffeine can be a game changer is in very, very long ultra distance stuff where you have to go through the night. So if you're doing 24 hours or more, I think the prevalence of people giving up and DNFing in really long races due to fatigue and just general unwillingness to go on in the wee small hours of the morning. So they're sort of 3-4 in the morning when your body clock is at its lowest ebb and fatigue is highest. The prevalence of DNF at that time is very high. And I'm sure that there is a strategic use of caffeine that if you used it through the night in order to help get over that bump. I've done a few races that have been that long where if you can get through to the next morning where the sun comes up, it's amazing how much better that makes you feel. And you need to get through that dark patch. And in that case, if a strategic use of caffeine can make the difference between you giving up or not, it obviously has a monumental impact on overall performance because you either finish or you don't.
Yeah, no, that's a good example. And you mentioned before we started recording an example from the Ultra World, what was it, 52-hour event with very high intake of caffeine. Can you repeat that for the listeners?
Yeah, so Damien Hall, who's an ultra-distance runner in the UK, he's placed in the top 10 in UTMB and things like that, so he's a very good level. He was doing the Spine Race, which is a multi-day, non-stop ultra in the UK in the winter. He actually was leading this race and I think would have almost certainly gone on to win it. He had to pull out after 52 hours, which was very deep into the race, because he's just had an unfortunate slip and strained his groin, just a freak sort of accident. But he was leading the race, going really well, feeling really good. And after 52 hours, he'd taken nearly 1400 milligrams of caffeine, which is 22 grams per kilo of body weight. But clearly within 52 hours, any of the caffeine that he'd taken at the start would have been fully metabolized out of his system. And so that was still a relatively high dose, but if you take that as 52 hours as, you know, five blocks of 10 Ironman races, that's only just over 5 milligrams per kilo for each of those time periods. So it starts to make some sort of mathematical sense that wasn't an unreasonable dosage potentially for him during that time. And all the evidence pointed towards the fact that strategy was working really well for him. He appeared to be dripping caffeine in fairly frequently throughout, and it seemed to be doing the job for him. Certainly wasn't having any detrimental effect.
Yeah. And by that same logic, would you assume that if that 67 milligrams per kilogram body weight over the Ironman distance for your elite athletes in the case studies is a good amount, more or less optimal amount on average, again, would the ideal, quote unquote, ideal amount for an age grouper that is out there for 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 hours, would that be more than for the elite athletes just because they're out there for a longer time?
It's plausible that it could be. I think especially if you're someone who's a pretty heavy caffeine user in day-to-day life. But I would say it's probably as much that it's related to your everyday usage and therefore your tolerance level as it is to your level of performance. Your level of performance definitely impacts the duration, and you're right in that the longer the duration goes on, you're out there for longer with more opportunity and more time to take caffeine and more time for it to be useful. So you might expect it to creep up. But I think a factor that relates to that heavily is this, the sort of idea of tolerance and daily habitual usage, because if you are a heavy daily user, you're going to need more to get an effect. And if you're a lighter daily user, then you're going to need less to have the same level of stimulating effect.
Yeah, makes sense. And are there anything to consider regarding the source of caffeine? So there are gels, as we mentioned, there's Coke and Red Bull is commonly served in these races. Of course, the morning espresso, and there are chews and tablets. Anything to consider there, or are they all good sources of caffeine without too much significance where you go to?
Yeah, I think like with carbs, like with fluid, like with salt, it's about finding dosage forms that work for you. The most significant advantage that sports nutrition products offer over having a coffee or whatever is, well, there's twofold. One is the dosage is very clear. If you take a gel with 100 milligrams of caffeine in it, you know, you're getting very close to 100 milligrams of caffeine. If you have an espresso, there are so many variables that go into the amount of beans, how fine they were packed, you know, how much pressure was used, that the variability on what level of caffeine you're getting there is quite high. So you kind of, it's a little bit more vague. But if it's a more pleasant way to start the day, you know, certainly I'll always reach for a coffee over a caffeine gel first thing in the morning, then, you know, it's certainly, you know, very viable. The other advantage that formulated sports nutrition has is that clearly during the race you can carry it with you and know what dosage you're getting on a regular schedule, whereas you're not going to be stopping for a coffee, or I would assume, or taking any kind of organic product with you which contains caffeine that's going to no doubt be difficult to store and carry and eat on the move and that sort of thing. So I think basically it comes down to practical considerations, but other than that, it's milligrams in your system that matters.
Yeah. And I think there, just as with carbohydrates as well, if you're planning on using, for example, Coke, I like using Coke in some races, at least as a potential option. And I don't always have it, but in some races I do. Or Red Bull, which I don't use, but I know some people like it. Then you kind of have to have a reasonable idea of how much you actually end up drinking when you get a cup of Coke or Red Bull. So, and then actually know, okay, so if I have 50 milliliters or 100 milliliters, you know what that number is. And then you also need to know, okay, what is the number of carbohydrates in 50 milliliters or 100 milliliters and the amount of caffeine, so that you can actually tally up everything that you're having and know if you're on plan or if you're getting off plan, just because you obviously won't have a label on that cup of Coke.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's always really tricky to estimate on the move, but at least if you have the raw numbers in your head, you know that 100 milliliters of Coca-Cola is about 10 grams of sugar, carbohydrate, and it's about 30 milligrams of caffeine, then at least you can keep a bit of a running tally and sort of figure out that's what you're getting in. If you take about 100 milliliters of good solid mouthful, you know, that's, yep, that's kind of a good estimate to have in your mind.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we should know, whether it's on the practical side or the theoretical side about caffeine that we haven't talked about?
I think the only, not, there's not, we've touched on a lot of things there. I think the main summary points for me are around, first and foremost, the process for using caffeine really is figuring out that whilst it works for the majority of people, the first question to be asking is, should I be using it myself or not? And that's a very fundamental question to answer. A lot of adults have answered that question for themselves in day-to-day life already, because we're so exposed to caffeinated products that you kind of soon figure out whether they work for you or not. And I think we all figure out to a degree our level of sensitivity and tolerance as well, because I work in an office full of people here at Precision Fuel and Hydration who all have different caffeine habits. You know, very rarely will you see me at the coffee machine in our office after 11 a.m. And it's rare that I'll have more than two, possibly three coffees in a day. But I have colleagues who can smash five or six very strong coffees right throughout the day with no bother at all. So we kind of all figure out what those levels are, whether we can use it, what our levels are. And then taking it a step further as an athlete, it's that thing that I keep repeating is like understanding what your individual numbers are, looking at the science, looking at, we've got some good blogs on our website to help you get in the zone for where it might be, but then taking the reins and taking responsibility from there and going, well, the science says that maybe it's between 3 and 6 milligrams per kilo, but I seem to be good with 7, or I seem to be, if I take 2, that's enough for me. It's just then honestly figuring out by trial and error what works for you. And I think if you take those two major steps, then you're very close to then optimizing your own use of caffeine.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect summary. And I do want to talk about one more topic because it's been a while since we talked about it, and I'm sure that you have learned a lot since then. And it is about sodium, and in particular, with you now having the amount of case studies of athletes that you do have, any numbers or any guidelines of how much sodium to replace? Let's assume here that the athlete knows their sweat rate in the race conditions they will be racing, and they know, or they have a good estimate of their sweat sodium concentration, so they can roughly calculate how much sodium they will be losing. How much sodium should they replace then? Is it 20% or 50%, or what? Do you have any sort of advice on that front? Because that's something that's come up for me, and I've been thinking about, and yeah, realized that I don't have a really great answer to.
A good rule of thumb, yeah. It's still, Michael, a really, really difficult question to answer, even with the data we've got in case studies, because the reason it's so difficult, I think, is there are some athletes at the lower end. So if we take the extremes and work in, because that's probably a good way of doing this, if you start with a theoretical athlete with a relatively low sweat rate and a very light level of sodium loss doing a shorter version of the long endurance event, so let's say a half Ironman as an example, we do see examples of athletes who can skirt through a short to medium endurance event like that with relatively little sodium intake at all and perform really quite well. They need to drink fluid, especially if it's warm, but if their sodium losses are light, there's a point at which where even replacing a small percentage of that is likely to be close to unnecessary. Now, those people are a small minority, but they definitely exist. We definitely see them. And they tend to be, and again, this might be a generalization, but they seem to be people who also often perform pretty well in hotter conditions and things like that. They're relatively economical with their sweat and sodium loss, in the replacement of their sodium. Their sodium is low requirement for, and fluid they can do by feel, by drinking to thirst and that sort of thing. If you then jump to the other end of the scale, we've got a couple of great examples of athletes now who have extremely, like really, really heavy sweat and sodium losses. And often the battle then isn't defining a percentage of what they can replace. It's figuring out how much they can tolerate, because they're never going to replace 100% of their losses. If they're sweating 2.5 liters an hour, losing, close to 2000 milligrams of sodium per liter, that's 4,000 milligrams of sodium per hour and 2.5 liters of fluid, your gut can't get anywhere near tolerating that. So we've seen some athletes now drinking well in excess of a liter an hour with nearly 2000 milligrams of sodium per liter, and that's enabled them, as very heavy, very salty sweaters, to function and finish reasonably competitively in longer, hotter races. But they're probably only replacing, I don't know, maybe 50% of their losses, but that seems to be just about enough to keep them in line. And so at the extreme ends, it's kind of not a worry figuring it out for some people, because they just go with their instincts, do what they need to do. If you're taking sports nutrition products of any sort, you generally get a little bit of sodium, some electrolytes in, along with fluids, and then that appears to be enough. And at the other end, we've got people who have to make a concerted effort to essentially drink and consume as much sodium as they possibly can, with absorption and stomach and gut being the limiting factor, in order to keep going. If you then slide between those two, we've always said, something between like 50 and 70, 80% of losses seems to be sensible. And I would maintain that that's probably still about as good an estimate as we've got at the moment, because what you've got to remember we're seeking to do when you replace sodium and fluid and to a degree carbohydrate during an endurance event, the aim of the game is maintenance of homeostasis. It's maintaining things like blood volume in order that you can still keep functioning. And we know that 100%, aiming for 100% of losses is probably unnecessary and unhelpful, because it puts a lot of strain on your stomach and your GI tract, and isn't necessary. We know that you can finish a few percent dehydrated in most cases and be totally fine and recover afterwards. We're designed and built to be able to function like that. So replacing a reasonably high percentage of losses helps the body with homeostasis, and as long as it's not causing GI distress, ought to be more beneficial than taking less. So I don't know if I've really... I certainly haven't answered your question fully directly, but I think over time we're homing in on it, but it is very individual. The question is probably, if we take an individual and look at their situation, can we try to appreciate what percentage of losses they might need to replace? I think we're getting closer to that. Can you say it's 70% of losses or 60% of losses or whatever? I don't think you'll ever be able to say that, because I think it's unique to the individual and the circumstance.
Yeah, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I would think that maybe it's more about an absolute threshold in how much sodium you can lose than a relative one as well, potentially. But that could also be related to the individual rather than that you can 100%. Give a number.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that entirely. I think you're along the right lines. I think what we've been theorizing is that there's an absolute level of sodium loss and fluid loss. Often they go hand in hand, but they can be independent variables as well, that causes a catastrophic change in homeostasis that the body can't cope with. And that's when you start to see those kind of problems, be that cramping or breakdown of some sort in the body. And if you look at that situation, it has to be individual, because every body size is different. The volume of fluid carried by that body, intracellular and extracellular, is going to be different. So it'll be related to that body. And then it's further confounded by the idea of like how well stocked on sodium and fluid are you, how well hydrated are you before the start of an event? Because we know that, for example, we've talked about this, you and I have talked about this numerous times before, but the habit of athletes over drinking water before an event in a bid to stave off dehydration can actually have a negative impact on their sodium levels, because you end up peeing out so much sodium that you can start a race on the back foot from a sodium perspective, mildly hypernatremic, because you've over consumed water, in which case your reservoir of sodium, as it were, is already depleted before you start. So trying to nail all of those things down is lots of moving parts, but the theory of what you're talking about there, I think, is it probably holds true that for most people there will be an absolute level of sodium deficit that starts to become problematic, and the level of supplementation needs to keep you one step ahead of falling into that catastrophic level of deficit.
Yeah, and that would explain why some people, probably quite a few people, can do even maybe up to a half distance triathlon without really thinking about sodium. But then, because they don't get past that threshold for them, but then when they get to the full distance, it's different. Or for other people, it might be that they can do an Olympic distance without considering sodium, but when they get to the half distance, then they have to replace it and replace it quite well.
So, yeah, I know. Yeah. And to continue along that line for a minute, because I think it's important. We've obviously there's a lot of opinions, as we've talked about before, in the world about this particular topic. It's quite an emotive topic for some sports scientists and coaches and athletes. And there's people that agree with the line that we take at Precision Fuel and Hydration, and there's people that very vehemently disagree with it. But what I tend to see quite often in the people that really vigorously disagree with it is that they've had experiences either directly through them as athletes themselves or with athletes they've worked with where electrolyte supplementation hasn't been particularly beneficial or useful. And then the extrapolation from that is that therefore it doesn't matter for anyone. And I think that's a dangerous place to go, because we know for sure, if you look at some of the case studies on our website, that there are cohorts of people for whom aggressive sodium and fluid supplementation during long events is absolutely critical, not only to them doing or performing optimally, but to even finishing at all. If you want to see extreme examples, then if you go into our case studies and look at the ones for Luke Henderson, who's a top age group, he's sort of a nine and a bit hour Ironman age grouper in Australia, who has exceptionally high sweat and sodium losses. He was advised by one of these famous triathlon coaches who's done very well in Kona and who is skirted by on relatively low sodium and fluid intake, saying that now you just need to drink to thirst. You just need to drink water, you know, drink to thirst. Don't worry about electrolyte supplementation. And he's ended up in the medical tent numerous times with that advice. He's moved to a strategy with extremely aggressive supplementation and started finishing races regularly and getting PBs. And I think where we can be mischaracterized and misrepresented is that therefore becomes the message that we are pushing, is that you need large volumes of fluid and sodium for everything that you do. And that is not the case. It's absolutely about individualization. And there will definitely be athletes and people who can skirt by with very little. And at the far end, there will be people who use loads. And everyone else exists somewhere on that continuum between those two. And whilst that's not a really complex concept to get your head around, it's one where it just requires a bit of time spent thinking about it to figure out the nuances of where you sit along that line. Are you more likely to be someone who needs a lot, a moderate amount, or a little? And once you figure that out, you can, and that's what the tools and services that we have are kind of geared at doing, is helping you to figure that out and then giving you tools to make those strategies real.
Yeah. That's a good summary. So let's finish off. First of all, can you just briefly mention and talk about the new caffeine gel that you have out? And if you have any other projects that you want to mention, or races or events that you will be at during this summer. This episode will be released in beginning of July or so, I believe. So yeah, any precision, fuel and hydration related things that you want to talk about, please feel free.
Yeah, so the new caffeine gel that we've released very recently is I don't know what to say other than it's the same as our PF30 gel. So it has 30 grams of carbohydrate in it, and it also has 100 milligrams of caffeine. Very, very simple. And one of the key things we wanted to do was make sure the product was very clearly labeled. You know, it's 100 milligrams of caffeine and 30 grams of carbs. So as a component of hitting your numbers, it's really easy to use. And then the other thing was, we really needed it to taste good, because caffeinated products generally don't taste fantastic. And I think we've nailed that one, in that it's a very, very neutral taste. And so far, they've been road tested at the World Championships. They've been road tested by a lot of athletes in training now. And it's probably the one product that we've been asked about the most in the last 12 months. So we're really stoked to actually finally get it to market. So that's really cool.
Yeah, that's good. I haven't tried it yet. I just got it yesterday, actually, but looking forward to trying it out. And any other precision fuel and hydration news, events or similar that you want to talk about?
Yeah, we've got, we have got now launched a fueling planner, fueling and hydration planner for the races. So as you well know, Michael, as you've been involved with what we do for a very long time, and we've had the online version of a sweat test to help guide people into which bucket they land in terms of heavy sweat and sodium loss, moderate, light, or very light. And we've also developed the quick carb calculator, which was an idea of giving people a quick reference to how much carbohydrate they might need per hour based on the intensity and duration of an activity. It's always been the plan to put those two things together to create a more comprehensive race fueling and hydration plan. And that's what we've got with the new fueling planner. So increasingly that's being rolled out at the moment. That's available online. It's it covers triathlon, running and cycling at the moment. And we plan to add other sports across and other distances as time goes on. And I think for me, I'm very, very proud of that product. The team here have put an incredible amount of work into the technical side of it, but also into the kind of IP that's gone into it. Because as you know, the sports science team here do a lot of one-to-one video calls with athletes, pro elite level, right through age group and amateur ranks, right down to beginners. And we've assimilated a lot of knowledge about fueling and hydration plans from that, also from the academic studies that we've done and from the sort of case studies we've done with athletes. And all of that, we've really tried to sort of put all of that IP into the back end of this fueling planner. And so the idea with it is you can be signing up for a race. You can say, I'm doing Ironman Hawaii. We know the weather conditions, what they're likely to be. You can put in a bit about your performance and your history. If you've got things like sweat test numbers, you can put those in. If you just want to take estimates on those, you can use sliders to give yourself estimates. And the overall output is a fueling and hydration set of guidelines that then enable you to go off and play around in the right zone for you with how much fluid, sodium, and carbohydrate you might need to take and how to do it in that event. And I think that hopefully starts to address a huge gap in the market between people having to read and interpret research and opinion online themselves to work out their own plan, or going the full hog and hiring a full-time, you know, sports dietitian to do it for them. We're trying to give people a tool there so they can get a good way down the process themselves for free online. And so far, the uptake on it has been, and the feedback's been really good. But I'd love for people to have an opportunity to use that.
Yeah, I tested the beta version of it, as you know, and I was very impressed by it. Not just the output that it gave in terms of the plan itself, the amount of carbs and hydration and sodium and so on that it recommended, but how it wasn't a black box in the way that I could hover above my recommendation for carbohydrate intake, for example, and it would explain to me kind of a bit more about, okay, why this carbohydrate intake, and the same for the other factors as well, which I think is really, really important, because we're in a day and age where there's a lot of technology and a lot of things that are kind of black boxes, essentially, where they will recommend things without explaining the why. And for me, at least, that's something that I don't really like and I don't really trust. But yeah, so that's one aspect that for me personally was a big positive and a unique thing with your calculator that I think is worth highlighting as well.
Yeah, that's nice. No, it's good of you to say, because I think that is one of the aims, is to make the information as useful, authentic, and transparent as possible, because ultimately what we want to do is get people in the right zone for their fueling. And then if they want to jump in and use more of our resource by having one-to-one video calls with us and stuff, we've got a solid starting point for them to go from. And they've already got a little bit of embedded knowledge from the reading they've done on the fueling planner. So yeah, really, really excited to get that out, you know, more widely.
Okay, so let's do the rapid fire questions again, because it's been a long time since you've last done them on this show, so things may have changed. And the first one is, what's your favorite book or resource related to endurance sport?
So this one, I would say not necessarily fully related to endurance sport, but if you bear with me, it is related to the theme of what we've been talking about. And there's a fantastic free book on Audible, if anyone's got an Audible audiobooks account, and it's called Caffeine by Michael Pollan, investigative journalist. And it touches on caffeine in sport very lightly in one place, I think, but overall it's a fantastic history of like how humans started using caffeine, how we found it, how it evolved economically, what it does to the body. It's just a great read. So totally different track to what we've been talking about in the highly specific use of caffeine. But for general grounding, it's only 2 hours long. It's free on Audible, and I found it really enjoyable.
Yeah, no, that's great. And correct me if I'm wrong, but last time I asked you this question, you said Boys in a Boat. Was that you, or am I misremembering?
No.
No, that was not you. Okay. No, I was going to say that I finally read that book and it was great. But
I might look that one up there. What's that one about?
It's about the US Olympic gold winning team from the Olympics in Berlin in 1936 in rowing. And they're the University of Washington crew. And apparently they're making a film about it now as well, which cool. Maybe this year or next year.
Yeah, I've not heard of that one. So I will that's a good recommendation for me. Thanks.
Yeah. It might be that Paul Newsom recommended it, and I know you're a good friend, so that might be why I mixed it up. What's an important habit that you've benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
Still probably the best one that I have, which is not uncommon for endurance athletes, is getting up and getting my exercise session done very, very first thing in the morning. I don't manage it every single day because with my wife wanting to exercise and the kids need to be got ready for school and all those kind of things, it can be tricky. But I think I'm pretty proud of the fact that in my mid-40s, I'm still able to race and compete with some of the younger guys in our office. And I think that's consistency built on years of getting up early and getting an exercise session done first thing on the morning most days.
Yeah, that's awesome. And who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
Someone who has inspired me recently is someone who's actually passed away, I think, relatively recently. And he only inspired me through his book. But the founder of the Vans shoe company, Paul Van Doren, wrote a fantastic memoir called Authentic, which was about how he started that business and grew it and his family life alongside it and all the rest of it. And it's an incredible entrepreneurial story. And it's a story about a very determined guy who achieved a hell of a lot in his life. And I would highly recommend it. So I did not know the guy at all. I know clearly, like a lot of people will, about his business, but I found that to be a really inspirational book that I would recommend to anyone, particularly if you're of an entrepreneurial or self-employed mindset yourself. It's a fantastic read, really inspiring.
So Andy, thank you so much for that. People already know where they can find you. It's on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And you have your new social media handles, which are Precision F and H across the board. So that's also good. And you mentioned free video consultations if people want to have feedback on their hydration and nutrition strategies. So yeah, there's plenty of ways to get in touch with you, and your team is absolutely great at answering any questions that people might have, whether they use your products or not. So yeah, again, Andy, thank you. It was great to chat to you. Thank you for all the information that you shared.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the invite, Michael. Anytime, always love having a conversation.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview with Andy. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. There are plenty of links for this one, including several blog posts on caffeine that you can find on the Precision Fuel and Hydration blog. They're linked to in the show notes. And also, all of Andy's previous appearances are linked there. And finally, the episode that I did with Dr. Ajmal Ali on the science of caffeine. So that's well worth checking out if you want to get a real deep dive into the science of caffeine and endurance performance. And while you're on the website, if you're interested in taking your triathlon performance to the next level, then check out our training plans or coaching services. We would love to help you out, so you can always contact us and we can discuss how that can best happen depending on your particular circumstances. So check out the options that we have on scientifictriathlon.com and contact us to learn more. A big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and most importantly, your swim training consistency. Get 20% off your order on the swim trainer with the promo code that you can get on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. And don't forget that it's a risk-free investment. If you don't love it after 2 weeks, send it back and you'll get a full refund. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.